Welcome, everybody. PersonalGrowth.net presents Personal Growth and Positive Psychology Through the Prism of Ancient Jewish Wisdom by Dr. David Pelkovitz, Ph.D. Dr. Pelkovitz holds the Gwendolyn and Joseph Strauss Chair in Psychology and Education at Yeshiva University's Azrieli Graduate School. He also serves as Special Assistant to the President of Yeshiva University. Before assuming his position on the faculty of Yeshiva University, Dr. Pelkovitz was a clinical professor of psychology and psychiatry at New York University School of Medicine and director of psychology at North Shore University Hospital, NYU School of Medicine. Dr. Pelkovitz has published and lectured extensively on a variety of topics related to the psychological impact of trauma and loss, child and adolescent behavior problems, parenting, and the impact of divorce and stress on children.
Thank you so much for inviting me. What I'm going to speak about today is part one of a multi-module series on happiness. It's going to be a focus on happiness first filtered through the prism of more secular perspectives and positive psychology, where there's much wisdom. But then the following module will be on happiness from a Jewish perspective. And then a third module will be on actual interventions to try to promote happiness in our lives, both informed by the secular as well as the Jewish perspective. But today we're going to focus on happiness from a secular perspective. First of all, why is it important to understand happiness? And I think that the very crucial focus that we've been hearing more and more about happiness as opposed to more of a focus on psychopathology like depression or other difficulties is because by focusing on how to bring positive emotional states to our daily lives, we could really greatly transform the quality of our lives. Research shows over and over again in multiple studies in psychology that people who are happy are less selfish, less likely to lose their temper, less likely to be perceived as hostile or abusive. In a number of studies, they're found to be more loving, more forgiving, more trusting, energetic, decisive, creative, and helpful. And when you put this all together, it almost sounds like overstating the case. But we all know it. We all know how when we're in a really bad mood or going through a period of sustained sadness, we're really not our best selves. Our best selves come out when we're able to get in touch with an inner core and an inner spark of happiness. I'm going to open this segment by talking about a double enigma, two brief vignettes that contrast the general secular view of happiness to the Jewish view of happiness. I'm not going to answer the enigma till the end of this segment. Story number one is from one of the best-selling all-time, best-selling nonfiction books of all time by Dr. Viktor Frankl. Many of you have heard of this book, Man's Search for Meaning, and it talks about Dr. Frankl's experiences as a psychiatrist who was himself an inmate in a concentration camp, and he found that those who were able to somehow hold on to a sense of meaning, a sense of purpose, were those who were most likely to make it through the camps. And there's a remarkable but very confusing story in his book. He talks about a young woman, barely out of adolescence, and he's the doctor assigned to the typhus ward. And she's literally in the last minutes of her life. And she calls Dr. Frankl over, she motions to him, and she says, "Doctor, I just want to tell you something." She says, "My life was pretty frivolous until I came here. I wasn't very interested in anything that was important. My concerns were mundane and silly and really not based on what's really important. But," she says, "now, at this moment, as I look through the crack in the ceiling and see God's beautiful sky and see the branches of this tree outside, I think I understand what life is all about. I am truly happy." And as she says this, she closes her eyes and dies. Pretty remarkable. How do you make sense out of a woman in the final moments of an all too short life, somehow squeezing a sense of beauty and happiness in the darkest of all places. Enigma number one. Enigma number two is a more personal story where I was the psychologist at a retreat for families of children with cancer. And it was a retreat that I've been privileged to be part of every year for the last 20 years or so, where I volunteer to be the psychologist at this retreat, and families come from all corners of the United States to basically strengthen each other through an organization called High Lifeline. And they strengthen each other. They come from very, very different backgrounds, but they all have in common the fact that they have a child with cancer or some other serious illness. And we're sitting down as the day is ebbing on the second day of the retreat, and there's a chassid, a bearded chassid, who is sharing some of his thoughts as the sun is setting. And he says, you know something? He said, this last Rosh Hashanah, this last Jewish New Year, I took my son to the hospital, and we were very worried about him, and he received a diagnosis of having acute lymphoblastic leukemia, having cancer. And then he says the strangest thing happened. 10 short days later on Yom Kippur, I was sitting down in synagogue, and I was surrounded by my family. I was surrounded by my friends and surrounded by my religion. And a wave of happiness washed over me like I've never experienced in my entire life. And I hear this. This is a number of years ago. And I was shocked. I couldn't understand what he meant. But I was even more shocked by the reactions of all the other parents sitting around him in a circle with tears in their eyes, nodding in agreement. So here's the enigma, the puzzle. How does one understand that in both story number one and story number two, at what should be a low point in a person's life, they describe what is an emotion that's totally confusing? It's an emotion that they're actually labeling as happiness. And I want to argue that it's through understanding some of the insights in the Jewish community and the Jewish thinking about happiness that we can come to a better understanding of how to bring happiness into our lives. But I'll start with a brief hint, and this is the etymology of the English word happiness. I don't know if anybody knows what the etymology of the English word for happiness is, but it has its roots in the, I think it's Latin or Greek root for hap, H-A-P. And just think about it. Think about all the words in the English language with the word hap. Haphazard, happenstance, as well as happy. What they have in common is their words having to do with chance. That if one is lucky enough to happen upon good fortune, happiness will ensue. And I'm going to contrast this a little bit later after reviewing some of the secular literature on what leads to happiness in a way that we're going to compare the English word happiness to the Hebrew word simcha, which is the Hebrew word for happiness. But first, let's talk a little bit about what it is that happiness is and happiness isn't through the prism of psychological research. And the first is obvious to most of us, anybody who's lived a life at all with any kind of insight and any kind of introspection knows that we learn pretty quickly that the connection between money and happiness or material things and happiness is pretty ephemeral. So let me just do a brief review of the psychological literature on this. Research clearly shows that, for example, a new car will make you happy, but not for a very, very long period of time. Lexus used to have an ad that I loved. The ad was, it had a picture of a Lexus on the page of a magazine, and the copy of the ad was, anybody who says money can't buy happiness hasn't spent their money right. And it shows a picture of a Lexus, sort of alluding that if you have a Lexus, it'll give you sustained happiness. But we all know what that's like. We get incredibly excited about the new car, the new house, the new computer, and it does make us happy. But for surprisingly short periods of time, the new kitchen hardly ever makes us as happy for as long as we imagine. And in fact, research done by Dr. Gilbert, the psychologist who's an expert in this area, has led to him labeling a word called miswanting, which has to do with the mistakes we make in choosing what gives us pleasure. On average, he finds that the bad events in life often prove less intense and more passing than one would predict, and good events prove less intense and to bring us briefer periods of happiness than one would think. And Dr. Gilbert says that the Stones said it best in their favorites, in the famous song of the Rolling Stones. They say, "You can't always get what you want." And Dr. Gilbert says that actually it would be wiser to say you can't always know what you want, because we often wish for the wrong thing. We wish for something that'll bring us happiness, and it isn't really the answer to true happiness. Let me move on to talk just briefly about what we know about the money-happiness connection. And this is probably not going to be surprising when you really think about it. And it's basically that common sense would say that obviously you could be very poor and not be happy, and that's of course true. But once our basic needs are met, once we have, you know, the basic needs of clothing and shelter and food in a basic way, the research repeatedly shows that there's not any kind of sustained difference between the ongoing happiness levels of somebody who's rich and somebody who is lower middle class. Basically, possessions do not buy us any kind of ongoing happiness. Yet many, many people, especially in the United States, don't believe that. You ask the average American what would make them more happy, and they will pretty quickly tell us that, oh, if I just made a little bit more money, I'd be happier. Yet if you just look at it in a broad kind of way over the period of the last number of decades, as the standard of living in the United States has doubled, corrected for inflation, at the same time, rates of depression and suicide and anxiety and substance abuse have close to tripled. Depression is up, even though standard of living is also all the way up. So obviously, the money-happiness connection is not one that is a very reliable one. Because what happens, and we all know this, especially now that it's December and it's bonus time in many businesses, we all know that the more money you make, the more you want to make. That's a clear truism almost. Because what takes over is something that psychologists call relative deprivation, which is we may think that if we only made $10,000 more or $30,000 more, we'd be happier. But in fact, what we tend to do is once we make that extra money, we compare ourselves to the next guy. I once had somebody in my office who came in and he was clinically depressed, and it was about February or so, and he told me he'd been depressed since December. He was an investment banker back in the go-go days of investment banking, and he said he received a bonus, and the bonus was for $100,000, an enormous amount of money by most standards. So I asked him, "And you're depressed, why are you depressed?" He said, "Because the guy in the office next to me, who's no better than me, he received a bonus of $200,000, and I just can't get it out of my mind." Let me end this section of the money-happiness connection with my favorite story about money and happiness, and it's the story of Robert Frank. Robert Frank, who's a well-known economist, who's an expert in this area, and is himself a pretty comfortable person who lives a nice lifestyle, has the following amazing story about himself. He was an idealistic young man when he graduated college, and he volunteered for the Peace Corps. So the Peace Corps flies him to Nepal, where he's going to volunteer for the next 2 years in Nepal to be a teacher. And they pick him up and they drive him to the middle of the country. and they drop him off, and they say, we'll pick you up in 2 years. And where do they drop him off? They drop him off in the house that's going to be his home for the next 2 years. It's a one-room hut with no running water and no electricity. And he's in a state of horror. He doesn't know, how am I going to survive for 2 years in a one-room hut with no water and no electricity? And he actually surprises himself because he sees that around him, in that part of Nepal, everybody's living in a one-room hut with no running water and no electricity. And what amazed him was how quickly he got used to that standard of living, because it was no different than anybody else's. But here's where the story really gets interesting. It's when he gets his first paycheck. His first paycheck is for $40 a month. Again, he's in a state of despair. How can I possibly survive on $40 a month, he says. Until he finds out that nobody in that region of Nepal is making more than $30 a month. So he's making $10 more a month than anybody else in the neighborhood. And he goes on to write that he never felt wealthier in his life than he did living in Nepal on $40 a month in a one-room hut with no water and no electricity. So that's the first main point I wanted to make, which is the point that the money-happiness connection is one that is far from as solid as one would think. As we know clearly from our own experiences, there are wealthy people who are happy and there are poor people who are happy. And there are wealthy people who, in spite of their money, are never satisfied with what they have. As Solomon says, Ohev kesef lo yisba kesef, which is translated as, he who loves money will never be satisfied with the money that he has. And in fact, the research shows that. It shows that when money becomes the center of one's existence, one is more likely to be less satisfied with life. One is more likely to want more money, to be less apt to share, to have an overall poor adjustment, to be dissatisfied with one's job and pay, and even to have low energy. So that finishes the first section of this module on what positive psychology tells us about happiness and money. And the question becomes, what is it then that does predict happiness? What is it that does become associated with ongoing happiness? And there, we only have to turn to what Dr. Myers, a well-known expert in this area, calls the three Fs. He says it's not the F of funds that psychological research tells us is associated with happiness, but it's the F of family, friends, and faith. Let me start first by talking a little bit about the family and friends connection, which is basically our connection to others. And I'll review some of the research on it. First of all, we know the connection to others is associated with actually better health. So the people who live in communities where they feel connected to others are healthier and are happier than those who don't. In fact, the Harvard School of Public Health has done a study of 50 states in the United States where they find that when you have a state that has what they call low social capital, meaning where residents don't really trust one another, and where they have a low kind of feeling of connection to the overall community, one's health is actually impaired. And one's chances of becoming ill are increased by 40 to 70%. And moving to a high social capital state does almost as much good as quitting smoking. Probably makes sense to quit smoking and to live in a high social capital state. But let me end this part of the three Fs by talking about my favorite study in this area. It's a study of Roseto, Pennsylvania. Let's talk about Roseto. Roseto was an area that totally baffled medical researchers who found a very strange health pattern in Roseto. Roseto was an area that was noted to have a very low rate of early death. It was almost unheard of in Roseto to die a premature death, let's say, from a heart attack, from an MI. It was actually the adjusted heart attack risk in Roseto was less than half of that of its neighbors. So medical researchers, of course, wanted to understand this. They thought maybe they exercised more, maybe their health habits were better. And they moved in and intensively studied Roseto in every area they could imagine. And relative to other similar communities in Pennsylvania, there was no difference in diet, no difference in exercise, no difference in the average weight of a Roseto citizen or the smoking, or even genetic predisposition of anything. There was slightly higher risk on some of those risk factors. But then they figured out, what was it that gave Roseto the edge? It turns out that what gave Roseto the edge was they were very different in their basic values relative to similar towns in that section of Pennsylvania. Roseto was settled by a group of Italian immigrants who settled there in the late 1800s, most of who came from the same village in southern Italy. They had an incredibly strong sense of community. There was a shared belief in religious values, a shared belief in helping others out, a very strong ethic of volunteering to help others. The old people in Roseto used to sit on their front porch and mind the business of all their neighbors, but in a way that was actually incredibly positive. If a teenager was foolish enough to cut school in Roseto, all the old people in town would grab him or her by the ear and drag them to the principal's office to make sure that the principal insisted on that child staying in school. What happened to the Roseto, though, in the 1980s? The young generation started to reject the incredibly close lifestyle brought over from southern Italy. They started to even change the architecture of the houses so that you no longer had the front porches. You no longer had the old people sitting on the front porch and socializing and talking to people walking by on the road. Garages started to have an automatic garage door opener. So you could live and die in Roseto without having the slightest bit of contact with your neighbor. Things fundamentally changed. Today, Roseto actually has a heart attack rate that is higher than that of neighboring towns. What an amazing story I find that to be. It's basically showing in such a strong way that strong family values and strong connection to the community is tied to happiness, is tied to health. And we find the same thing when we look at friendship and well-being. We find that close relationships predict health. I don't want to bore you with a million kinds of statistics, but study after study after study shows that those who place a value on family, those place a value on community and on friendship have a much higher happiness level. This isn't only found in the United States, it's found in countries around the world. What about the F of faith? There, the same thing is found. Those who have a strong intrinsic faith tend to have higher happiness levels. Every day a week that somebody attends religious services, their happiness levels go up. Actively religious people are much less likely, the psychological research shows, than irreligious people to have problems with delinquency or with drugs, alcohol, and sustained depression. So let me bring this to an end. What was I talking about before in terms of that double enigma? What I was talking about in terms of that double enigma is answered by the difference between the English word happiness, again, based on one becoming happy just by having the luck of having more money or winning the lottery, as opposed to the Hebrew word simcha. The Hebrew word simcha is, in one level, if you look at it, two Hebrew words, shem and moach, where your head is at, it's translated into. Happiness comes from a connection to that which is greater than us. As the great Jewish rabbi, the Chazon Ish, said, for he who knows the light of truth, there is no sadness in the world. How does that answer the enigma? The enigma is answered by looking at what was the experience of that young woman the last minute of her life. She was feeling deeply connected to something beyond herself. She was feeling deeply connected to looking up, as she said, at the beautiful sky and at nature, and at a sense of belonging to something greater than herself. She was connected to the transcendent, shem moach. It's where your head is at. When your head is at connection to that which matters, happiness is what envelops you. The same thing at that retreat for the families of children with cancer. That chassid sitting down only 10 days after the diagnosis of his son with cancer is enveloped by a feeling of happiness because, as he said, he was surrounded by that which mattered most to him. He was surrounded by his faith, he was surrounded by his family, and he was surrounded by his friends. In our next meeting, we'll talk about some deeper insights about happiness as informed by some of the really amazing insights contained in the Jewish literature on happiness and how we get. And let me open this now to questions from anybody out there who has questions on this. Please feel free to ask.
If anybody has any questions, you can press *6 at any time. We will get the question. And until then, if I may ask a question, Dr. Pelkovitz.
Sure.
Based on what you're saying, how do we understand this in context with nature versus nurture, something we're born with versus something we learn over time? Can happiness be learned, or is someone who's depressed, can they learn to be happy, or is it something that they're born with?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And the reality is that, sure, we all know that there's a strong nature component to happiness. There are people who are born in a way that they do see the glass of water as half empty instead of half full, and those people, in fact, research shows, are more prone to depression, are going to have a harder time experiencing sustained happiness. But like almost every other personality trait or tendency or propensity, nurture trumps nature. In the work of Dr. Seligman, Martin Seligman, who's the founder, or one of the founders of positive psychology, he says that, he actually more than says, he's proven in a series of studies that you could take somebody who is prone to depression and is very likely to, because of having negative thoughts and negative beliefs about themselves and the world, to experience depression. And what Dr. Seligman has developed, along with many of his colleagues, is a cognitive behavioral approach where you help people systematically change their thoughts, systematically change their beliefs, catch the thoughts, the fleeting thoughts they have that are unhappy, and replace them with more rational, more optimistic ways of thinking. He wrote a number of books on this, one called Learned Optimism and the other called The Optimistic Child. And to just give you an example of the level of his research, in Optimistic Child, he took a group of children in a suburban Pennsylvania school district, and he screened them, and he found exactly the people that you're talking about, a subset of kids who, from a nature standpoint, were more prone to depression. They were the pessimists of their school. He then did a systematic kind of intervention with these kids to teach them how to think in a more optimistic way, to teach them literally optimism. And he worked with their parents as well, using a manual that's reprinted in Optimistic Child. And he actually was able to prove that he was able to permanently change them from pessimists to optimists. And relative to a control group, they were at lower risk for depression and more able to have sustained happiness. So, of course, it's a greater challenge for some people to be happy. But the work of Seligman and others in positive psychology have found that it's possible to override that and have a sustained kind of change in propensity to happiness.
That's very interesting. And what would you say are a few practical things that can make the change? Catch thoughts, replace them, and
right. So that's the third module in happiness is actually some very specific interventions from positive psychology on ways of trying to develop that kind of sustained happiness. Coming attractions.
Great. Well, is there anything else before we close this call, Dr. Puppet, that you'd like to add?
No. If there are no more questions, then we'll have another meeting and talk about this more from a Jewish perspective.
Okay, and just to refresh our memory, next module is going to be on what exactly?
Happiness from a Jewish perspective.
Okay, great. So we will let everybody know when the next module will take place. And Dr. Pelkowitz, thank you very much for your time and your insights and your expertise.
My pleasure. Looking forward to talking to you all next week. Thanks.
Thank you.